across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. And this edition of The Unexplained, you will hear in place of my radio show on the Sunday, with any luck. So this is a big, long conversation we're about to have with Linda Moulton Howe. Lots to talk about. Also, a big list of your questions I'm going to get through with Linda. So stand by for that coming very soon. Update on the TV show, the next edition, or the next scheduled, or would have been the next scheduled edition of The Unexplained, will be in television. So May the 1st is when all that begins. Please be there, because I'm going to be very nervous about doing that. So that's when the TV show replaces the radio show. But I think some people have got the wrong end of the stick about that, and maybe that's my fault. The sound from the TV show will continue to be available on the radio, so that's not going to change. But the show will originate as television, and if you have a standard Freeview domestic terrestrial TV in the UK, you will be able to see me on Sunday nights, as you've heard me on the radio. I've had a little bit of a break from it over the last couple of weeks. I've still been around doing things, and I've still got a lot more things to do. But come May the 1st, that is the future, as they say. Shout-outs. Dawn in Derbyshire. Nice to hear from you, Dawn, again. A shout-out for John in Swindon from Chris. Steve in Bangor, Northern Ireland, thanks for getting in touch a couple of times. Steve, Uber in Zurich, good to hear from you. Brian in Calgary, thank you for your emails recently, Brian. Nick in Bar Harbor, Maine. Simon also. Julie sent me an unexplainable photo, that's what she titled it, but didn't actually attach the photograph as far as I can see it. So Julie, you've got to send me that again, okay? What else? Paul Bean sent me two images taken in the northeast of England near an Air Force base, but all I can see in those images is a dot. I think you need to contact somebody who can really unpick that video, or rather that those images, and see what's lying beneath them, because all I could see was blackness and a dot. But then I've only got a standard domestic computer here. Why not try sending this to Jason Gleaves or to MUFON, and maybe try and get them analysed by people who know that stuff? Hans in the Netherlands sent me some footage of a grey alien. I think that might be a famous hoax video there, Hans. I'm not sure, but I think it might be. Leo, who listens on the commute in New Jersey, is there. Nice to know that you are there, Leo. Ashley, thank you for your communication. And Jacqueline, thank you for sending me a number of things, including your stories of flashbacks to a car accident that you were never involved in. That's astonishing. Have you been through something, you know, in your waking state, flashbacks to a thing that you were never involved in and that never happened for you? Also, Lee, thank you very much, Lee, for getting in touch. Thank you to the listeners in the United States, mainly, who sent me dental advice recently. The upshot of that is that I've left the dentist that I was seeing and who estimated £30,000 for treatment, and I'm now starting to get some treatment with another dentist. We'll see how that goes. Simon says, I'm a huge fan of your show. Thank you, Simon. And wondered if you've ever covered the Children of Woolpit story from the 12th century. I haven't. I'll try and find out more about it, Simon. Thank you. John says, hi, Howard. I was thinking about reports of shape-shifting UFOs when I realized just how normal this is. To put it into perspective, you only need to think about how our own space exploration craft have been shape-shifting. Apollo 11, three humans on a return journey to the moon and back. The Saturn V starts out as a huge rocket, and within minutes it turns into something smaller. So I guess we've been doing shape-shifting, just like the ETs might have been. A true story from Rennie. Rennie, nice to hear from you again. Dear Howard, I've been following your excellent show for many years, thank you. And I've always heard how well you speak of your father, how he was a police officer, and how he wanted you to become one of them as well. I come from a family of variety and circus entertainers, and my father was the reason that I became interested in UFOs because of an incredible story that remained in the family until now. When my father was young, he toured Australia with Worth's Circus in the late 1950s to the early 60s, doing an acrobatic act called Harstens from Denmark. Okay, turning the page here. Rennie says, my father had just gotten his driving license and was returning to the circus with his uncle in the car. They were somewhere in the outback of Australia, and it was close to dusk And they were driving on one of the Australian roads that are very long and straight for kilometers with no traffic. At one point, they saw a very bright light shine in their mirrors, and they thought it was a truck with full beams on, so they slowed to let it pass. But instead of passing, the light went from behind them to above them, bathing the whole car in a very bright light, of which they later said was stronger than the spotlights that shone on them when they were on stage. There was no noise. Then the light shot out from above them and disappeared over the horizon. They could only see the light and no shape. Their car didn't stop and there was no missing time. They just continued driving back to the circus, and that was their experience. I always heard this story from the family and also asked my father's uncle about it, and the story never changed in all of the years. They also told nobody outside of the family either. I also swear that this is the truth and not something that's made up. An astonishing story. My father died last week at the age of 83 when you were writing this. My condolences, Rene. So this is the first time that the story is out, and I wanted to share it with you. Well, I'm honored and privileged that you did that with me, Rene. Thank you. Just before we get to Linda Moulton Howe, this. Potentially very exciting news. I'm in some discussions for the first time about taking The Unexplained live later this year. What that might mean is that you will get the chance to see some previous guests on stage with me, and hopefully we'll get to meet each other face-to-face for the first time in all of these years of doing this, 16 years or more. So keep listening, and I hope to be able to reveal the guest list and some more information about this and the dates when this might be happening in coming weeks. So that's a little bit of news about a new departure. So this year it's going to be television and maybe something that's in person as well. Watch this space, or rather listen to this space, as they say, because we're still on the podcast here. Linda Moulton Howe, friend of mine in this show for more than 20 years. She's an American investigative journalist and regional Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker, best known for her work as a ufologist and advocate of a variety of theories, including her investigation of cattle mutilations and conclusions that they are performed by ETs. She's also noted for her work suggesting that the US government is working with aliens. That's just one version of the biography, and is a summary. Not a fair one, because if I was to give a proper summary, then we would be here for at least half an hour. She is, as you will probably know, an amazing woman, somebody who's been working in this field diligently and continuously for decades upon decades. One of Art Bell's stalwart guests. That's how I discovered her, and I'm honored and privileged that Linda Moulton Howe over the years has spoken with me. So we're going to get to the mountain time zone of the United States, 7 hours behind where I'm speaking with you at the moment, and speak with Linda Moulton Howe in just a moment. Thank you very much to Adam, my webmaster, for getting this out to you and for his work on the website. And thank you to you for all of your emails and communications. Please keep those coming. Go to my website, theunexplained.tv, and you can send me an email from there. And, you know, I greatly appreciate the fact that you are right by my side on all of this, you know, as I sit here this evening. I did manage to do a tiny little bit, you know, a couple of days of traveling in the last week or so, just out of London. So I did manage to just get away from it all. But one of these days I will have to take what they used to call a proper holiday. And maybe I'll get to America again, perhaps, if funds and time and everything else allows. And that's, as they say, another story for another time. All right, let's get to the United States. And welcome back, Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, thank you very much for coming back on my show.
Thank you, Howard. It is always great to be with you, because I think you are really seriously interested in the evolution that we're in, a revolution that we're in right now, to the headlines around the world. We're not alone in this universe. That is a fact, and we need this planet to get to that point.
And we seem to be reaching, and we'll get into this as we talk, though, Linda. You know, I think more and more people, I was speaking with my sister. I had a couple of days away and I had a lot of digital conversations with my sister who lives up in Worcestershire. And, you know, we agreed that there is a great feeling out there now that something is about to happen. You know, a lot of things are reaching critical mass. We've got conflict. Right. We've got political instability and some corruption and systems that we have depended upon for so much of our lives. seem to be reaching some kind of critical mass or tipping point. So I think a lot of people, even if they're not interested in the stuff that we talk about here routinely, are sensing that things are changing.
Right. And it reminds me of 2014. It was a meeting that I had with a physicist who did work at Area 51 underground in S4. You can take that to the bank. And it was it was at a conference, and it was where I have found that people who have sensitive work feel that in the milieu of a lot of people and a lot of noise and us speakers being down in a crowd after doing a presentation, that some people feel comfortable to at least lean forward and say, I have something to tell you. And that's happened to me several times in conferences. And this was one of the important ones. And this man, we went away from the conference to talk one-on-one. And he showed me enough ID to establish who he was and how he had access, where he had access. And he wanted me to know that he had worked on the bismuth magnesium zinc underground in S4, and that he had worked on a slab of this material that was 6 feet by 3 feet, taken from one of the crashed extraterrestrial technologies back in the 40s. And there had been an evolution of study in these highly classified labs like S4 of this material.
So this is the often referred to sort of magic material that had properties that we did not at the time understand. In fact, its existence was denied, but that is what we've come to understand.
Well, remember, I am the only person who was investigating and reporting about this from 1996 for 10 years. And asking on the air, it became one of the subjects that was constant. And Art Bell was host, and he was always asking me to do updates. And I was reaching out to physicists, I was reaching out to metallurgists, I was reaching out to people who were doing X-ray crystallography, confirming that the little pieces, I said this physicist was working on a 6 foot by 3 foot piece. All we had from a box sent to us by a U.S. Army sergeant via his grandfather, who had worked in security back in 1947-48 time period, and that's how these pieces emerged, were little pieces that the grandfather had in a box when he died. And the grandson was contacting us. And eventually, I am the only person who ever talked to him. He said that he was en route to Iraq and that he did not know if he would return, and that he wanted to talk with me personally to tell me that in spite of the controversy about the bismuth magnesium zinc, which he did not know anything about, it was my going to labs and reporting what scientists were finding, and that he was letting me know he was grateful, and that if he got back, he would get back in touch with me, and he wanted me to see his grandfather's diary. Mm-hmm. That would have been really something, but I have never heard from him again since that call. I have no idea whether he survived Iraq or what happened, but the baton was passed to me, who went to a lot of scientists to try to understand what this material was. And in a short summary, the first really viable studies were done at the University of Michigan by a scientist working there who asked me to keep him anonymous. But we were able to confirm that they were approximately 1.25 inch long by, depending upon which piece and how it had been cut, by about 3/4 or 1 inch wide and irregular shapes. And the analysis from the beginning held up over time that the black layers were 1 to 4 microns, very, very thin, of bismuth, and that the silver layers were 97.6% magnesium and 2.4% zinc. Now, put in your mind a tort cake of layers, and that they are all alternating pure bismuth, 1 to 4 microns, with the magnesium zinc, which were thicker, and they altered all the way of some 26 layers was one piece that this scientist counted.
26. Then, and what properties did the scientist believe that that imbued this material with?
No one had a clue right from the beginning. And that was reinforced by a call that I made to a metallurgy lab in New Jersey, probably within 3 to 4 weeks after we had received two shipments. One was high grade, 99.7% pure aluminum. That was one shipment. And then the second shipment was this bismuth magnesium zinc. And when I called the metallurgy lab in, I think it was in New Jersey, it was one of about 115 calls that I kept a spiral notebook of everybody I was calling, people that I was arranging to send a piece of these pieces to for analysis. And when the metallurgist in this lab in New Jersey came on the line and I explained that I was investigating a metal piece that had been confirmed at the University of Michigan of being alternating layers of pure bismuth with the magnesium zinc alloy layers, he laughed. That was the first thing on the phone. He started laughing and he said, "It's impossible. You cannot put together layers of bismuth with layers of magnesium. It will delaminate." Well, I still have a piece from 1996, and this is 2022. It has never delaminated. And that led me to do an investigation with Cranford Labs in, I think it was outside of London, where somebody said they're very interested. They've heard your interviews on Art Bell, and the lab would be interested in seeing one of these pieces. And I said, if they can tell me if this is intelligently organized at an atomic level, that's information I need. And the Cranford lab, they never gave me and would not, because that was, I thought, was going to be the agreement. I need a paper, formal analysis of this material, which everybody else was giving me. Even Stephen Chu, who won the Nobel Prize for his semiconductor work, he contacted me, said he wanted to see this bismuth magnesium zinc that I was reporting about. And Stephen Chu had a piece for about a month and returned it to me, as all the scientists did. He said, "This is not a semiconductor. I do not know what it is or what its function is." And I have all of this in a binder of all these letters going back from 1996 to the current day. So when the New Jersey metallurgist laughed, basically saying nobody could do this, I knew that I was in completely uncharted territory. And eventually, I told Art what we need to do is we need to get this piece into an ion microprobe to analyze at the atomic level what is the isotopic ratio in this magnesium, for example. Because in the UFO field, going back to the 1950s, stories out of Brazil and other places would come unsupported by laboratory documents, but reported by people who said they had seen the work, that magnesium was found in different metals at different crash sites And there was a famous case in Brazil in which a physicist reported that it was outside of Earth's normal isotopic ratio in magnesium 26. There's magnesium 22, 24, 26 on the Earth, and that they come in various ratios. And the fact that UFOs are associated with highly unusual amounts of isotopic ratios in magnesium is what led me to get in touch after research with, get this, in 1996, July, there was only one ion microprobe functioning in either Canada or the United States, because I had checked in Canada as well. There was only one that could do an isotopic ratio that would include magnesium and bismuth. And that was in the Carnegie Institute in Washington, D.C. And I arranged for a meeting. I was working and living in Philadelphia at that time in 1996. So I said, I will drive with this piece down. And I arrived like at, I think it was at 10 o'clock. And we worked all day. I think it was a full 8 hours. And you don't get a skilled ion microprobe operator to give that much time unless he is absolutely fascinated by what he is finding, which was the case. And the more work he did, the more he wanted to test. And in the end, his summary was, in his work with ion microprobes, he had never seen pure bismuth like this in a 1 to 4 micron layer, because on the periodic table, bismuth is next to lead. And you always have, he said, I've always found lead atoms in contamination with bismuth. And this one has no lead. Second, he said, and he took probably 2 or 3 hours on this one question alone. He told me right in the early part, I am getting ionization off of the magnesium and I do not understand why. And he said, I would like to try to get to the bottom of this. And that meant that positive ions were coming off of the magnesium layer of the tort, which is bismuth and magnesium zinc alternating in this layer. And at the end, he wrote up, and it's all published in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. And it has the ion microprobe information and the graph that the ion microprobe analyst, Eric Howery, gave to me. And it summarized that for reasons unknown, the magnesium in this layered bismuth magnesium zinc metal allegedly taken from the bottom of a UFO in the late 1940s by the security guard whose nephew or grandson would deliver or send to Art Bell and me in 1996, it emitted 11% more positive ions than normal magnesium.
In other words, it was a generator.
It was emitting ions, plus there was 11% more magnesium 26 than there was in the control piece of normal magnesium from Earth. That didn't kick this into extraterrestrial automatically headlines. Here is layered material that has extraterrestrial outside of the box amounts of magnesium 26, but it was 11% more than Earth. And that was noteworthy. And that's why it's in my book. Well, as I was continuing to reach out to different scientists, Hal Puthoff, who is a physicist who worked at Stanford Research Institute and then started his own institute in Austin, Texas, known as Earth Tech. And he contacted me and he wanted to work with the bismuth magnesium zinc in the context of his years of, as we know now, that he was doing highly confidential work with the CIA, the NSA, the DIA on a lot of matters related to UFOs and the physics of them. And Hal had the piece one round, returned it, came back for a second round, returned it, but that led to the period of the To the Stars Academy that Tom DeLonge, the rock star, started, and that Hal put off. And people who will say were related, like Lou Elizondo from the DIA, CIA, NSA, they came together around this bismuth magnesium zinc investigation that Hal put off had not been able to follow through on what he wanted to do. Jacques Vallée had tried and with me and had been all through the year of 2017. I was working with Jacques Vallée, and then Hal came back for another round. And what they now, by 2018, Hal put off, Jacques Vallée and others, they had concluded that. And Hal did the calculation that he sent to me in a formal letter that's also in my binder, that if a certain level of terahertz frequencies high on our electromagnetic spectrum were focused on this bismuth magnesium zinc layered material, it could turn into a lifting body because there would be impact on gravity. Relationship to this skin. They called it a skin. That was connected to information that Hal had, I think Jacques had, from inside government sources that have not been made public, but here's the bottom line. I started with telling you that in 2014, this physicist walked up to me at a conference surrounded by people and said, I want to talk to you. And now I'm going to insert the piece that he gave me in 2014 before the 2017-2018 serious laboratory efforts by Hal Puthoff and Jacques Vallée, and they still couldn't do what I'm going to tell you right now. The physicist told me that in the 1970s, he worked underground in S4 on a slab of the bismuth magnesium zinc that I've just been telling you about that came off of a craft from New Mexico. Would not give me the specific date. There have been many, more than has been made public. Mm-hmm. And that he wanted me to know that it was the skin on the outside of wedge shape, specifically wedge shape. Think of a piece of pie. That's exactly also the description that was used by the grandfather in the diary that came with the bismuth magnesium pieces, that he had pulled them off of the bottom of a wedge shaped craft like a piece of pie. And why did he pull them off in the late 1940s as a security guard? You would think he would be afraid of being shot on the site. He said it was because the bottom of the wedge shape glowed for 3 hours before the light went out and nobody knew what it was that was glowing, and they were Army security. And he decided to walk over and see if he could pull off anything that was glowing at the bottom of the craft. Now, the physicist who was brought in to investigate this slab, the 3 foot, 6 foot slab, came from probably that same craft that the grandfather pulled some pieces off because it was brittle and it came off in his hand as he touched it and pulled it. The physicist said, this is the outer skin of wedge-shaped UFOs. It will not do the work that everybody thinks, neutralizing gravity, unless there is an interior skin and the interior skin, he said, must be pure aluminum. That was the first shipment. The first shipment that the grandson had sent to us was the aluminum pieces that I have also in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness. And it was in the beginning, that's what we had. We didn't get the bismuth magnesium zinc until 3 or 4 weeks later. So my first investigation was on these strange pieces that were sent with the original letter. And there was somebody had called because Art had put a photograph that he took of the first pieces, the aluminum pieces. He had put that in something that he had done on TV. And he had a reply from somebody at that time in April of 1996 saying that looks like aluminum. So in my first efforts in my spiral notebook was to get in touch with Corning aluminum, Alcoa aluminum, sorry, and sent them one of these pieces that were oval and in squares. And everybody had said, well, they look like they're dies that have been cut out of something that was bigger. And I'll never forget, because that was the beginning, not as interesting and sexy as the bismuth magnesium zinc was, but it reinforces what the physicist would tell me in 2014. I get a phone call. It is a man at Alcoa. He said, where did you get this metal piece that you sent in for us to analyze? And I said, it came to us in a box, allegedly from an army sergeant whose grandfather was a army security at one of the late 1940s Roswell UFO crashes. And the voice said, well, we don't manufacture aluminum this pure. He said, this keeps coming out at about 99.78% or 99.9% pure aluminum, and we don't do that.
Right, and they are the leading producers of that material in the U.S.
Exactly. So now, back to 2014, many years later, that I'm at that conference with that physicist. And he's telling me the key is that both are skins. He said, I've seen it. I've studied both. You need the bismuth magnesium zinc on the outside of the craft. You need the pure aluminum, but here is the kicker. He said, in the pure aluminum, you must be able to place at the atomic level, not molecular, at the atomic level, iridium atoms. And the iridium atoms need to be placed in a mathematically calculated way. And once you have that, and you put that skin around on the inside of the craft, and you put the bismuth magnesium zinc on the outside, those two skins working in parallel with all of the computer energy systems in between that were what? Those were the fiber optic glowing ranchers who saw one of these crafts said it was broken open and it looked like horsehair that was glowing at the ends. Fiber optics. Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso said that when he worked in the Pentagon with General Trudeau, a colleague of General Eisenhower, that General Trudeau opened a filing cabinet where he was keeping extraterrestrial technologies that were taken from various crash sites. And one of them, Colonel Corso, said, I understood why some of the ranchers said that they found horsehair that was glowing. Fiber optics were inside of those craft, and there was no such concept in the 1940s of lasers, fiber optics, neutralizing gravity. But that is where it began, Howard. That is the back engineering that has led to where we are today. And to cap this all, I was told a year ago by a person working in a huge if I told you the name, you would go, oh my gosh, aerospace company who told me we now are working with extraterrestrial allies in 22 solar systems, and we have been doing so in an evolutionary way since the end of the 1970s. We are out into this end of the Milky Way galaxy. Okay, back to the 2014 physicist. Mm-hmm. He said, you need to understand that we already, by 1972, 3 years after the Armstrong landing on the moon in the famous steps, he said, 3 years later, Linda, we were going out of our solar system with an in craft of extraterrestrial humanoids who have concern about Earth, who are concerned about what is happening in the evolution of Homo sapiens sapien, and they are trying to help us. And that came from that physicist who knew all of those details in 2014 that I told Hal Puthoff and Jacques Vallée and reported publicly, because that's what I consider my work to be. And that led to the work that TTSA eventually did, where they were trying to apply, and the terahertz frequency that has been so elusive, how could they do that? The 2014 physicist knew all about it, told me about the frequencies, told me how difficult it is for human earth science to apply those terahertz frequencies to these materials, but that is the key. And that is exactly what Hal Puthoff had written to me back in the 1990s period, and ended up in a 2000, I think it was 2012. It was a letter to me that what he would like to try to do or find. And he said, Linda, if you can find somebody in a university, try these high terahertz frequencies focusing on this bismuth magnesium zinc layered material, because our math shows, and of course he had more information from the government, our math shows that these pieces should turn into lifting bodies. The physicist, though, said very specifically, if you do not have both skins in parallel that are somehow working through computer programming, you still will not have control on gravity.
So as far as you know, Linda, and I'm sorry to jump in here, just to focus it on today, are we still trying to work out how this conundrum can be made to work practically? Or have we already, with assistance from extraterrestrials, are we already using this stuff? And if we're using this stuff, is that what people are reporting sometimes as UFOs?
Think about it this way, that we do have allies that have a vested interest in humanity evolving, and it's not clear why. It could be asked why. Why would extraterrestrials ally with trying to keep humans alive? I don't have an answer to that.
And indeed, why aren't they approaching us directly? You know, if this is the big agenda, and boy, do we need help at this point, it seems to me, then why has it all been so cloak and dagger for so long? I think that's one of the many unanswered questions here.
Remember, Chaim Eshed came out with his memoir.
That's the Israeli guy, the guy who worked in the Israeli
of satellite defense, development in Israel. Brilliant, brilliant man. And he released in December of 2019,
I think, wasn't it?
It was 2020, wasn't it?
All right.
Because we're at 2022 now.
You know, these last couple of years have just glided one into another.
Okay. It was definitely 2020, because it wasn't this December. It was the December before. And Chaim Eshed released a memoir in which the epilogue at the end, after all of the stuff about history and government and satellite and all of that, is an epilogue, and it has a title translated from the Hebrew, We Are Not Alone. This is the, he was like the Elon Musk of Israel in terms of his mind, his energy, his ability to get this whole satellite effort in Israel to a modern top height. And he's so respected. And the fact that he would then, he writes a typical memoir and then the epilogue. We are not alone. And in that epilogue, which I worked with two men who were born and raised in Tel Aviv, who are now in Europe, they both contacted me and said, we would like to help you with the translation in the Hebrew. And the memoir talked about Mars, showed images. This was handpicked by Haim Eshet of what he says in his memoir are sure constructions on the surface of Mars, small but definitely constructions. Put the images in his memoir's epilogue. Talks about cases in California, a UFO that none of us really had much information about, which meant that Haim Eshet wanted this book to be some kind of a leverage open to his putting his name behind his epilogue title, We Are Not Alone, and backed it up with fascinating information in that epilogue. And when you look at where we are now in April of 2022, we have had the federal end of the United States government in the Department of Defense sort of tantalizing with the idea that came out of Congress, the 180-day countdown that was ordered by Congress for the Department of Defense to come up with to Congress and therefore to the American people information about what they want everybody to use now, unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs. It's just a dressed up acronym for UFOs that have been used as UFOs, unidentified flying objects, since Kenneth Arnold reported them for the first time in Washington State in June of 1947. And it was June 24th, Howard, people forget this, that the headlines in the West Coast of the United States were this pilot sees these nine, he said they were wedge-shaped or curved and did an illustration, that were moving sort of like stones that would be cast across a smooth surface of water. So they were hopscotching across the air. And that was the June 24th press conference with Kenneth Arnold. And it was July 2-4, only a week later, that the craft came down in the region between Roswell and Corona. They also came down around Socorro, Horse Springs. There were multiple craft. Why did they come down a week after the very first report by Kenneth Arnold in Washington? Well, Stanton Friedman and I had a long discussion about that question. God bless you, Stanton, wherever you are. He was a wonderful colleague and with a physics background. And we had a long discussion once when he said, our government knew about UFOs much earlier than 1947. They already had been dealing with the so-called Foo Fighters and strange craft during World War II. And the government of the United States secretly started working with microwaves between White Sands in southern New Mexico up to Los Alamos, which is where the physicist Robert Oppenheimer developed the very first atomic bombs in Los Alamos, and at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque. There was already the beginning of an underground that would be used to hide unbelievable amounts of material, and that they wanted to be able to protect this triangle from White Sands to Los Alamos to Kirtland. And the way they were experimenting in the 1940s was with microwaves. And Stanton is the one who suggested that what we were doing with the experimentation may have actually interfered with those craft that came down, multiple craft, not just near Corona or between Corona and Roswell. And then the technology, the minds operating these extraterrestrial craft did something to adjust, did something that countered whatever we were doing with microwaves, so that there was a wave of crashes. And then the craft, the intelligence, did something that countered our efforts with microwave. And so that was a discussion with Stanton Friedman that after his passing, I have had other discussions with people about the true history. We, Howard, what was actually happening from 1941 on in the United States during World War II, and what we were gaining, what we were hiding about what General Eisenhower, who became president, he clearly knew, based on everything that Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso has said about his work with General Eisenhower as president, with General Arthur Trudeau in the Pentagon, that the president already knew a lot about UFOs and ETs.
So as we've said a million times before when we've had conversations over these last 20 years or so, this entire topic has a history much longer than people realize, and it did not start with Roswell, as you say. Now, this year is Roswell 75. You know, the whole world will converge on that place. Do you believe that, in the light of what you've said, and, you know, I haven't butted in here, I've let you say it, you know, because it's a fascinating narrative, and what could I add? But in the light of all of that, do you think that we are being prepared at this point for something to be announced, or to be not necessarily announced, but to be allowed to get out on this 75th anniversary when so many things are all converging together? Do you think that there is an ongoing narrative that leads to a peak here, or are we just going to keep playing the cat and mouse game?
I don't think that Roswell will be used significantly, but what already is significant behind the scenes, because I know people who are already working, and that is congressional hearings are going to occur. And it's my understanding they're going to occur this year, and that they might occur as early as June or July, but not because of any anniversary in Roswell. That this has been an unfolding inertia coming forward, a lot to do with Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon and the people who have worked in the government, coming first through the To the Stars Academy route, which was supposed to be get this information out into the white world so that science and aerospace can be reporting and working publicly. Remember, they wanted to raise money to actually build a craft based on physics. But that effort didn't go as well as they thought. And then TTSA disbanded. But there were other, by then, there was, it seemed, to a growing consensus between people like Louis Elizondo and Hal Puthoff and Chris Mellon and others, that we are way past time telling this alleged government of, by, and for the people. We are way past time telling the truth. And
well,
that
well indeed,
right
it makes
now,
you wonder, and here I am jumping in. Why would we want to hold congressional hearings when there is so much information already there, it's just got to be released? What's the point of discussing it if it's already known?
Howard, it's never been made public officially.
Hmm.
Not once.
Why don't they do
not
that?
Not once.
Why don't they do that?
About, I've been trying to get to the bottom of animal mutilations for 43 years, going back to 1979, and having law enforcement and ranchers say and describe the beams of light coming out of round lights in the sky into pastures, ranchers seeing animals rising in beams of light, being returned in beams of light, then finding the animals dead and mutilated where there's no blood and no tracks, and an entire heart inside of a cow can be in a necropsy. The vet will find that there's no heart, but there's no excision in the body of these animals over and over and over again. And the government tried to have a mantra. When I started as a director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver, with the idea, I want to find out what is happening to these animals and why are ranchers and sheriffs saying that there's no tracks and no blood. What is going on here? And to my very first discussions with sheriffs and veterinarians who had actually seen, and the veterinarians telling me, I'm not going to stand up in front of your camera and tell the world this is impossible and it's being done by extraterrestrials. But Linda, it has to be, because nobody could do this. And that's where Sheriff Tex Graves, in my very first meeting with a sheriff, said, Linda, I'll save you some time. The perpetrators of these animal mutilations are creatures from outer space. And then gives me all the reasons why internal organs missing upon necropsies with no surgery on the outside. The fact that the veins and the arteries would be lacking any hemoglobin in them at all without any fluid on the ground or the hair, and on and on. So in 1979, as a hard-nosed science, environment, medicine, and medical producer for television, working in my whole career began at Stanford University, where I got a master's degree in communication and went to work as a reporter for KNBC and was married at the time. And my husband went to Harvard, and I was hired to do all the medical programming for the ABC station in Boston. And then we moved to Denver in his corporate work, and I was hired to be director of special projects at the CBS station. And my job was to do documentaries and live studio programs with people like the governor, which I did, on matters concerning the state of Colorado and the United States in science and environment and medicine. It was in that context that I took on animal mutilations. And 9 months later, it took 9 months to do the film A Strange Harvest. And when that was released, it was like a bomb went off. There were no computers. There were no teletypes at the station. We had phones and faxes. And yet, people around the world, that was what really caught my attention in the first 2 weeks. I wasn't getting typed or handwritten letters just from people in the United States. I was getting a mail coming from around the world, and everybody was saying, I have never told anyone this before, or I saw your film and you are telling the truth, and illustrations, and some people sending photographs. And I realized that I had scratched the tip of a huge iceberg that today, in April of 2022, 43 years later, we are still on a planet in which power brokers and government leaders have never brought together a press conference to tell this world of Homo sapiens sapien the truth. We are not alone in this universe. We never have been. That Homo sapiens sapien is a product of genetic manipulation of already evolving hybrids by extraterrestrial biological entities. That is the truth. Our government always thought that nobody could handle it. But Eric von Däniken has been doing the ancient astronaut theme for how long? Going back to the 1960s?
Well, yes, even before you were doing your work on cattle mutilation. Can I ask you a favor, Linda? You're blasting your microphone a little. If you can just be a little further back from it.
Oh, yes.
I know that the more enthusiastic you get, the closer you get to it. Can I bring you up to date here? On Earth Files, your website, which I recommend anybody who hasn't seen it yet, they go to now. You have a conversation with a guy called Adam Burns, who you've had a lot of conversations with.
I've had three.
Right. And he talks about his encounters with a so-called alien praying mantis. And I want you to talk, if you would, briefly about this. What Adam Burns told you about what the praying mantis is trying to prepare him and through him us for.
Yes, it is intriguing. When I think back at the first time I was shown an illustration by a human abductee of a praying mantis, that was clear. It was for my third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness, and it was in a 106-page chapter in which I had six people who had been, I guess I'll say, they had been subjected to missing time. In the missing time, they had begun to have memories, which is classic in the abduction syndrome. And then they had another missing time, and in their life, they were remembering more and more. And in this one case, Linda Porter from California, she was both an illustrator of great skill and was very articulate about what had happened, and describes coming out of this missing time period and then realizing that she's standing in front of an 8-foot tall praying mantis. And at first is terrified, but the praying mantis puts some sort of frequency that calms her. And then she is introduced to a gray as a scientist who shows her a whole row of humanoids, non-human and human, including herself, in tubes with light at the top and light from the bottom, preserving these bodies. The praying mantis communicates and the gray scientist communicates. And the praying mantis left words in Linda Porter's mind that she never forgot. We are going to translate you into the light. She did not understand what that meant, but she was shown and simultaneously told that she had had rheumatic fever as a young child. She was a teenager when this occurred. She had had rheumatic fever and it had damaged her heart, and she was going to die too early. And that this is the theme of many abductees about what I'm going to say next, that they communicated that they were working on a project that was involved with trying to sustain Homo sapien and the evolution of us on this planet, and that it was vital that the entity, which she understood to be the human soul, that the entity be in the collaboration with a specific human body for a very specific period of time, and that part of the work of the praying mantis and these grays was to make sure that certain humans that they were tracking, studying, helping, interacting, helping to evolve, it's unclear why the attention, but that they have focused trying to keep certain souls and bodies united together in organic life on this planet for certain lengths of time. And if something is going to cut that short, they will intervene and they will translate into the light of this technology, the person into a new body that will be either the same age or a little bit older or a little bit younger, but will be healthy so that the soul can continue on in that body.
So they're interested in a specific cadre of people, a specific group of people. And you say that they have been intervening with those people to make sure that they don't get sick and die, that they stay here and perform some kind of mission. Is that the story of Adam Burns, who you've been speaking with?
I think he would probably say, yes, I'm in that category. But we're now at 2022, and excuse me, we've had fires here. Pollen is, it's been, we've got five fires going in New Mexico, and I'm telling you, it's been hard to keep a clear voice. Adam is a very, very intelligent person who can illustrate what he sees very well. And I think if you boiled down everything that he and I have talked about, and I was trying to figure out, I've used the term, I think I have interviewed since 1979 to 2022. I think I've interviewed about 3,000 people in the human abduction syndrome. And that is a actually close and reasonable number.
That's a stunning number of people.
And I have so many audio tapes stored from all of those discussions, some of which I always promised that people's names would never be known. And therefore, I have all this material, but I don't know if I can ever do anything more than what I have done, which is 43 years of trying to understand what the big picture is, which is what we're talking about now. And Adam Burns, let's say that his perspective is one. Whitley Strieber, an author and a longtime abductee, has one, and that I've interviewed 3,000 people, not everybody having this experience of translation into the light, but many having pieces of this story. If it is true, if what Adam has been exposed to, and I'm doing part two on this next week's, the 27th of April, I'm doing a part two with Adam Burns specifically on the part of his last hypnosis, trying to recall these huge, huge amounts of information that come into his mind from the praying mantis and the grays. He feels for the first time in his life, and he's 54 now, he's had interactions most of his life since a child. And at age 54, it was the first time that I, in three interviews that have been on my Earth Files YouTube channel, that I have heard what sounded almost like happiness in Adam Burns' voice when he said, Linda, the praying mantis this last time showed me, and we're going to go into an illustration of what he was shown on the 27th of April show.
Can you give me an idea?
That humanity makes it. That in spite of all of the war and the violence and the rape and the maiming and the seeming out of control, that we are not living in collaboration with the Earth, that we are destroying our planet.
Right, but the news, I don't want to spoil your presentation for 27th of April, but the news is good that we're going to make it. Are we going to make it with assistance, or are we going to see the light ourselves and make it through our own efforts?
Both.
Well,
that if the praying mantis and those that work with the praying mantises, which the physicist in 2014 told me that he had been given some insight that the praying mantises as terrifying as that seemed to humans, that they actually had hugely long lives and were considered to be the overseers of evolutionary life projects in solar systems. Okay, so I've gotten various reports from various levels of profession that indicate our government does have knowledge about some of these beings. And in this case, the praying mantis would be an ally, like allegedly the Nordics and the tall whites are supposed to be allies with vested interests in the evolution of humans. But the grays may play all sides, that the reptilians are the most ancient and that they are always at war with the Nordics and the tall whites. And when you get to this level, it just seems like everything is chop suey. But then Adam says with that clear happiness, Linda, the praying mantis showed me, we make it. Humanity makes it. We are not going to self-destruct, which is what everybody feels right now in 2022.
Well,
that
I think
humanity will self-destruct
is enormously positive. And, you know, I don't want to spoil the content here, but certainly the first part that I saw of Adam Byrne's story was very compelling. And, you know, as you said, you spoke to 3,000 people. He is not alone in his experience. I wonder if I've got 10 great listener questions here that I've sorted out for you, Linda. Yeah. I wonder if we can work through these quite quickly, but you know, they're worth asking. And they're all about themes. They're all people familiar with your work, and they're all about themes that we've discussed here before. So I'm going to dive into these now. Anthony and Sue in Nottingham, we've talked about the cattle mutilations. They have been fans of yours since A Strange Harvest, since they saw it. They want to know, and I want to know too, are these cattle mutilations still occurring in the same way and at the same rate as they were?
Same way, not the same rate. The highest number of animal mutilations around the world took place for reasons unknown between 1974. You could go back into the end of the 60s. You could go to the horse in southern Colorado in 67. Let's say it starts there. And that between 1967 and I would put the number up to about 1997, in that period of time, there were constant mutilations somewhere on this planet all of the time. After I finished the documentary, A Strange Harvest, and it was broadcast for the first time on May 25th, 1980, I continued at the station until I signed a contract with Home Box Office. In March of 1983, 3 years later, in New York City, to produce an hour for HBO that would be called UFOs, The ET Factor, and a big part of my production already in a proposed script that HBO wanted very much to do was about animal mutilations and the fact that the bloodlessness of them, the no tracks around the animal, the law enforcement were willing by then to stand up and say the perpetrators are creatures from outer space was going to be one of the big parts of what I was going to do for HBO. And I think that HBO's phones are tapped, that my phones were tapped, that everything was known to the CIA, NSA, DIA for a huge complex series of reasons, but that they decided that for Linda Moulton Howe, who had a Peabody Emmys, was considered to be a very credible science, medicine, and environmental TV producer. That was my beat. That was why I went and did the investigation of the animal mutilations.
Sure. What can I tell Anthony and Sue, though? Can I tell them that these things are still happening, but perhaps not at the same frequency, and maybe there's a bit of a variation in the way that they're happening?
Well, the reason I'm telling you this is here I would have been putting out in the public in a huge venue, Home Box Office, the truth about animal mutilations. the government clearly did not want that to happen. And the interference with me, the interference with phones, the interference with everything that was so huge, and that documentary was the money was pulled out from under one of the high executives of HBO, who said, unless you can bring me the president of the United States, the vice president, the secretary of state, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I am not going to fund this documentary. That actually happened in HBO headquarters in May of 1983, two months after I had signed that contract. But this is important. It means that there were decisions that were trying to work against anything happening in animal mutilations. And I think our government stepped up their recording, their being sensitive to when UFOs were anywhere on the planet, sending jets to interfere. There's been a tremendous amount of more American intrusion on UFOs. And I think it was partly or largely because of animal mutilations. But let me bring you right up to this year of 2022. In January, I received information from a source that I know what they do. I know what they have access to. It came in a very safe way. And this individual said, I just want you to know, finally, you should have been told this a long time ago. The mutilations are done because the Greys and others need a certain chemical from this planet because they are both artificial intelligence and organic combinations. And they have found that unless these that are assigned to the Earth have this certain chemical that is from the Earth, their health and their ability to function declines. Now, I'm not saying that's been proven, but I'm saying that somebody who is reliable on other subjects, it is the first time in 43 years that anybody has come forward with something that would be
a reason,
explanation that would relate to life forms that have been interacting with this planet and have been here for millions of years. You can take that to the bank. And that we humans, our crossfade with Neanderthalensis was only 45,000 years ago. And we are dealing with conflicting extraterrestrial civilizations that one DIA analyst told me in December of 1999, Linda, our government has proof that these three competing extraterrestrial civilizations have been fighting over this planet for at least 270 million years. And he said, just put the ratio, 270 million versus the 45,000 crossfade with Neanderthal for current Homo sapiens sapien. We are babies in this, and that right now, if all goes forward the way I have been told by insiders, in 2022, no later than 2023, the headlines around the world in every village, town, large city, and beyond is going to be, we're not alone. The Webb telescope is going to be used to show some structures, and we will be tiptoed into, but never told in the beginning, the whole truth that I'm telling you today.
Gee, I've got nine more questions. I'm going to try and race through these.
Okay, and I'll try to do it in 30 seconds. Well,
I hate stopping you because it's all I always jump in on an interesting bit. But anyway, we've been doing this for years. We know. Tony Smith. I'm going to connect two questions here from Tony Smith and from Ian. They both are interested in the subject of human mutilations. And Ian in particular is asking if you're aware of any correlation between cases of human mutilation and the national park disappearances in the United States or indeed anywhere else. This is the stuff that people like David Paulides work on. You know, the people who simply vanish mysteriously and seemingly into thin air in America's national parks. So human mutilations, I'm compressing two questions into one. Do you think that that is a possible connection, explanation for those disappearances in national parks? Any thoughts?
I have been exposed to actual Royal Canadian Mounted Police description of a woman found in a car, completely dressed, with her left breast removed in a perfect circle in which there was no bleeding, no fluid. She was wearing a silk blouse.
Good Lord.
Okay, and that's one. John Altshuler, pathologist, hematologist. I worked with him for a decade before he was unfortunately killed because of a bicycle car crash. John Altshuler was the person that I called when I got a phone one day and said, a man has been found nude, lying face down on the top of shallow water in a lake. Can you do any investigation? And I called John Altshuler and I said, can you get in touch with the coroner? They told me that the body has been taken to the coroner. Because of who he was and the credentials, he was able to get the coroner on the phone. John Altshuler told me that the coroner confirmed bloodless excisions of penis, testicles, tongue, and rectum on this individual with no bleeding.
Exactly as has been happening for years to animals.
And that when John Altshuler said, can you please send me a formal report, the coroner hung up on Dr. Altshuler. And there you have right there the whole problem. The FBI and the CIA and the NSA and the DIA and geospatial and we have 17, maybe 18 now in the Space Force in the United States. They're the only people who ever get the facts on all of this. And therefore, you can say with speculation in mind, does 2 + 2 = 4? Would thousands of disappearing people on the planet fit into the category of what we've been discussing or not? How do you prove it? And you don't go on national television or satellite world television and say anything until you are able to provide the proof. And that is locked up, I'm telling you, in the black world.
Gee, that's astonishing, Linda. A lot more needs to be done about this. And as you say, you can't go speaking about this stuff until you know more. And if those agencies are stonewalling everybody, because they have to, how are you going to know more? I want to move on. Paul in Bournemouth on the south coast of England just wants to know briefly if you know any more about Antarctica. We had a conversation a couple of years ago on the radio about what might have been occurring in Antarctica. Do you know anything more?
My documentary, Antarctica, Alien Secrets Beneath the Ice, it was released by me at the end of 2018 in December. That documentary has been out in the world. It can be downloaded on Vimeo at my website, earthfiles.com. I urge everyone to see my documentary, Antarctica. It was done with a Navy SEAL that calls himself Spartan One in collaboration with a colleague who was a Marine. But everything that I did in the interview with Spartan One was not only backed up by another Navy SEAL who has an even larger career currently, who has been to Antarctica, to exactly where Spartan One describes. The other SEAL has been there 3 times. I have much more information, and I'm saying you need to see my documentary, Antarctica.
But in a couple of sentences, for those who haven't yet seen the documentary, and I'm sure they will, what what is in Antarctica? What's been discovered that we're not being told about?
2 miles down underneath the Beardmore Glacier area, about 4 hours from McMurdo, which is the U.S. Base in Antarctica. If you get to the Beardmore Glacier and you could go down 2 miles in a particular area, you would be in a huge structure that has a surface entrance, but goes down 2 miles deep. And that inside of these structures, as it declines down to 2 miles, are 9-acre sized rooms with ceilings that have been described. One room, 80 feet tall, another 30 feet tall. Neither of the seals understand why there would be such gigantic size in this structure, but all of the structure is made out of a black substance. There was a lot of volcanic basalt in Antarctica in the distant past. Could ETs take volcanic basalt, which is one of the hardest substances on the Earth? Could they make this gigantic structure that goes down 2 miles? And if they did when there was no ice, you have to go back 34 million years ago. Was the last time that Antarctica was tropical with dinosaurs, flowers, everything was tropical, and it had been tropical for 100 million years coming from Pangaea and moving south to the South Pole.
So that suggests that perhaps our predecessors were highly evolved, or there was somebody else here from somewhere else at that time.
That's right. And this is, if there is one sentence that you all remember, it is from the DIA analyst in December of 1999, who said, our government, meaning the United States, has proof that 3 conflicting extraterrestrial civilizations have been in competition with each other over this laboratory Earth for at least 270 million years.
Now that preempts a question from Alan, who's basically talking about this kind of thing, suggesting that there's a possibility that whatever was there may have predated the dinosaurs. So that's what he was talking about. Travis in Melbourne, Australia, I'm going to skip your question at the moment because we talked about all of this, about the exotic material, the bismuth exotic material. So I hope that you feel that we covered that, Travis, and thank you for your question. Scott in Carlisle, north of England, asks me to ask you what impact, if it's possible for Linda to summarize, has popular culture had on the objectivity of witnesses and your ability, Linda, to gather accurate information in your research? In other words, all of those people who you've been speaking with, and you told me that you've done 3,000 conversations with people who'd had contact, they believe. Scott is wondering whether popular culture is influencing people's ability to objectively report what they experience.
It is a reasonable question, but if you had been in my shoes since September of 1979, when I started my very first investigation of animal mutilations, to this day of April 20, we're at Saturday, the 23rd of April.
I've lost track of time too. Yeah.
Yeah. When you talk over that period of time, 43 years, with 3,000 people, I have a 6th, 7th, 8th, 10th sense within the first minute of whether I'm talking with somebody who is genuinely speaking from being stunned or not. You can't make it up.
Right. And only experience can teach you the difference between somebody who might have been influenced by something that they saw in a movie and something that they'd experienced in their sleeping hours or whenever.
And I have enough knowledge that I listen for certain sentences and words. Hmm. When I'm hearing from somebody that I know, this is, they have had a real experience in a completely different space-time with entities versus people who might just want to get on radio or television with me. That is not going to happen. That is not going to happen with me. I know the difference, and I always have. And there is, you could say all of this right now. We're on a planet in revolution at every level. It is headed into a completely new timeline. And in that revolution, we are either going to come out of this in this decade, finally, everyone being told about the space operations that we are already involved in, and the planet will begin to evolve, and kids will want to be physicists, kids will want to be pilots of space rockets. It could change this planet to something that's wondrous and positive.
Well, let's hope
out of this decade that we are not told the truth, and that the black world continues to have its claws on planet Earth, I do not think that humanity will survive to the next century.
Okay, well, that's a depressing outlook. Let's hope the former scenario, not the latter, is the one that transpires. Graham asks this, a fairly brief answer would be appreciated, Linda. But Graham asks, I was wondering if Linda had a theory on extraterrestrial life forms that might come here to visit us and how they become tolerant of our atmosphere and the environment here. I mean, look, if we go to Mars, it's a hostile environment. We have to make preparations. And what Graham is asking, you know, how do they adapt? How do they prepare? It's a good one, isn't it?
We are babies in the physics world compared to the non-humans who are interacting with our planet. If you had been exposed to what I have been from people in aerospace and science who have had communications directly in meetings with some of these beings, and you hear them say, my God, it is like being with somebody who has five crays for a mind. The idea that we would assume that beings that may have come into this universe that is 13.8 billion light years in existence, and that they may have come into being, let's say, 4 billion years after the Big Bang. We are only in 4.6 billion year old Earth. There could have been advanced civilizations that are already 6 billion years old. Their understanding of what is called the substructure of this universe, the mathematical language that is underpinning of everything, the fact that frequencies are the key to, are we in a third 3D matter? Can we go to fourth, fifth, up to 12? That the dimensional frequencies are what these non-humans can pop in and out of the way we would walk down a sidewalk.
Right.
We are babies. We don't understand at all that what we are interacting with, or it is interacting with us, can neutralize gravity, that can go 50 light years in five of our days, that they can go from universe to universe. There are multiple universes, and that there are 12 dimensions, and we are dealing with technologies that can go in and out of those dimensions.
So in other words, the answer to Graham's question really is that they're so evolved that the question is irrelevant, really. They've worked all of that out because they've worked everything else out.
Yes.
Right. Gee whiz, Linda. Raf in Stanwell. Raf, I'm going to have to paraphrase your question. I'm going to have to compress it somewhat. But have you got any authoritative idea that, you know, that you've arrived at of the number of races, species, gradations that we are dealing with in our interactions, you know, positive or negative with ET? In other words, are there 12 different species and races and gradations? Are there 1,000? Do you have any idea how many?
6 months ago, I received, as I do through Proton Mail, a sentence. Linda, I hear you. I am working in the Space Force. I am working on the engineering side, and I want you to know that we, meaning the ones on the inside, the ones supporting the Space Force, we acknowledge that there are 168 civilizations on this side of the Milky Way galaxy.
That's just around here.
The Space Force is now working in collaboration with other intelligences in 22 different solar systems. So take 168 civilizations on this side of the Milky Way, look across the gigantic Milky Way galaxy, and just take 168 and multiply it maybe by 100 times. But add this number. There is an estimated 3 trillion galaxies in this universe alone.
Wow. And that again is something else. Takes us back to Graham's question, really, that we're not equipped to encompass, to assimilate within our human brains. It's simply too large a magnitude, an order, I think, to understand. But if you think about it, if you think about the vastness that we're discovering, and we'll discover more with the James Webb Telescope, it kind of has to be like that, because the scale of it all is, our appreciation of it is ever expanding. I want to get to this question from John in Plymouth, Southwest England. I've talked here, and I'm sure you're aware of these cases, the Aerial School case and the Westall case from Australia in 1966 that I did something about only very recently.
Me too. I did too.
Are there any, John asks, are there any close contact cases like those that you find to be the most compelling and credible? Maybe if there's one that speaks to you, perhaps above all others.
Meaning that there is something like a school and there's interaction with craft and beings. I remember I knew John Mack at Harvard very well, and he was the psychiatrist who wrote a book on abductions and legitimized abductions. He single-handedly legitimized the investigation of abductions. And Dr. Mack was so provoked by the African landing at a school, and that he went there. He went to the school. He interviewed the students. He had them draw what they saw. He had the teachers draw. And I have always felt that that was so compelling, because John Mack was a very vigorous mind in psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And he was so taken and impressed by all of those children who were drawing for him. And so I think that the African case of the landing, which is very much like Westall in Australia,
but much more recent,
and was described in great detail in his book Abduction.
It is an astonishing case, and you know, I've actually spoken with, on one of the editions of my podcast, I can't remember which, one of the experiences of that day, when whatever it was went to the perimeter fence of that school in Zimbabwe. Astonishing story. Linda, listen, thank you very much. One last question that comes from me, and it's to do with a news story that I think appeared last week. A guy called Anders Sandberg, a senior research fellow at Oxford's Future of Humanity Institute, which until I read that news article, I didn't even know existed, warned us that sharing information, putting out, I think the way that the media portrayed this story a week or so ago, was putting out information, trying to make contact, is maybe not such a good idea, and that there are risks connected with that that we need to appreciate before we keep doing it. What do you think?
He was echoing Stephen Hawking, who passed a few years ago, but Stephen Hawking was one of the first powerful scientists to say we should not be sending our signals out because this universe could have something out there waiting to pounce. But what I've been exposed to, our own ancient history, Anunnaki, Sumerian, there is no question, the whole Mayan, Aztec, it wasn't evolving Homo sapiens sapien who built the pyramid of Cheops or the pyramids in the Yucatan. This is living proof on our own planet of the quote unquote ancient aliens interaction with sometimes guiding, sometimes testing, sometimes abducting for reasons that are not clear, baby evolving Homo sapiens sapien that what came into being by manipulation of DNA in already evolving primates, direct words from a government document shown to me at Kirtland Air Force Base, and that if John Mack and Bud Hopkins were sitting here, they would say, absolutely, is that the fact? We started out as somebody's experiment. Today, in 2022, going forward, it may be that somebody out there has decided that there is a unique and powerful soul in the Homo sapiens sapien, and that we are going to be helped to survive because this is a direct quote from an Air Force captain that I was able to hear that in late 1940s, an extraterrestrial biological entity was retrieved from a crash, was taken to Los Alamos, where it was kept until June 18, 1952. Every single day, they brought out a 16-millimeter camera. The Air Force captain sat next to the extraterrestrial biological entity and said questions loud on the tape. The being was only telepathic. And the Air Force captain then would tell the camera what the being was answering. And one of his questions was, is reincarnation the recycling of souls? Is it real? The being answered telepathically that went to a document that I have read. Reincarnation, the recycling of souls, is the machinery of this universe.
Boy, big, profound thought. Linda, thank you very much for giving me your time again. We've been speaking together for more than 20 years off and on. And ever since I first heard you on Art Bell, you remember there was a cast of characters there, people who appeared regularly. You did, playing your clips from your interviews off a little tape recorder pressed up to the phone back then. Things have evolved a lot since then. But, you know, there were people like Richard Hoagland on there and Major Ed Dames, a.k.a. Dr. Doom. And they were people who were regulars on that show. And I determined then that I wanted to get to know those people too, and I did. And, you know, you are a shining light. Do you mind me saying that I think you've just turned 80, haven't you, Linda?
That's right. I think of it truly as the 80th revolution around the sun. I don't buy in and never have to that you're supposed to at this age, get ready to die and retire. I just don't live life like that at all. And I have never had more exciting material coming at me every 24 hours than now. And I say to the universe, hey, give me at least 20 more years of good health and do it with a slight grin. But I now can understand that if you reach a point where you can control genetic manipulation and the praying mantis can have a life that is in the millions and billions of years to oversee solar systems, then you look at Homo sapiens sapien and say, why do we have such short lives? Why are we turning around every 70 to 80 years? Why was this machine this way by beings that demonstrate that they can live for centuries? I want to live for centuries. I want to keep doing this. I want to keep reporting about the entire universe. I would go on for 500 years if I could be healthy and my brain was strong and I would just, oh my God, I can't think of anything more exciting than learning about everything, every planet, every being, and reporting it to some universe, radio, television, web.
Do you know, I only have one thing to say about that. That's hallelujah. I'm completely with you on that. But I was watching you on video. I didn't realize you were doing these fantastic videos that, look like great 4K broadcast TV on your website. And I just thought, I've just read your date of birth in your biography. I don't believe it. So, you know.
Nobody does. But there's a difference between chronological and spiritual and mental. And if your spiritual and mental keeps your body excited and moving all the time, then I think it does make a big difference.
I think it's fundamental. I think it's at the core of everything. I think it's what keeps those of us who do these things going. And as I get older, I contemplate that fact more and more. Linda, thank you for giving me time again.
And Howard, thank you for being you and reaching out with such intelligence on these difficult subjects, but so important. We've got to get out of the silent room. We've got to get out of pretending on a planet that there's nothing else beyond us. It's crazy. And that is what I call abuse of humanity.
It is. Fundamentally, as Mr. Spock said, illogical. Linda, thank you. The great Linda Moulton Howe, don't forget her website, evolving all the time, is earthfiles.com. More great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained, so until next we meet, wherever that might be, my name is Howard Hughes, this has been The Unexplained Online, and please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. And don't forget, of course, if you find it possible to make a donation to keep the website and the online material coming, then please do that. You can do that at the website, theunexplained.tv. And if you have done that recently, thank you very much indeed. I'm out of time. I better go. There's a lot to do. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.